rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and happy new year. Welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wilson-Croft. It's 2021 and hopefully it's the year that football gets back to being its brilliant best once again. Our first episode of the year with plenty to discuss as always. Manchester City turn it on against Chelsea to remind us all that they're as good as anyone in the Premier League on their day. Sheffield United though show us they aren't quite getting better anytime soon. Are they a unique footballing case? Elsewhere, Premier League players ignore coronavirus guidelines. What do you do with the Covidiots? And we'll also discuss the new PSG boss Mauricio Pochettino and the funniest football fails you can remember. To help me through it all, Tom Roddy, Matt Dickinson and Gregor Robertson. Hello guys, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, yeah.
Nice to be greeted in such a strong manner by only Gregor while Tom and Matt just look on it. It's okay, guys. It happens often on this podcast. I give it the energy. I give it the big sell. I've got a big smile and I'm greeted by a wall of silence.
I think we need to raise our hands when we want to speak or something.
I blame it on Wi-Fi problems, Hugh. It just dropped out then, I promise.
Yeah. Hopefully everyone had a happy new year. Manchester City certainly did. Let's start with them. Pep Guardiola beat Frank Lampard's Chelsea 3-1 at Stamford Bridge. And Gregor, tactically, I'm most interested in what Manchester City did during this game because I'm not really sure what the secret to the win was. The first 15 minutes or so, it seemed like City, who were much changed due to positive COVID-19 tests, they looked a bit clueless. 5 minutes later, they looked like the best side in European football. What happened?
Do you know, I was thinking after the game that Pep's interview, rarely is he kind of very illuminating. He never looks like he wants to be there, but I've not seen him that happy in a post-match interview for a long, long time. And he's quite illuminating too. He was talking about, he used the word tempo so many times and rhythm. And you could kind of swap those words for mojo. It looked like they got their mojo back. He's talking about they have to make 1,000 passes playing with the rhythm and an intensity, and he was just delighted with what he saw. And I think that was the main thing. They were full of energy and they seemed to just be moving the ball quicker than they have in a long, long time. And you know, Pep also said they don't have the players to kind of to play in transition like they perhaps used to. Sterling's maybe one. Sané's gone. So they can't play like other teams who are being successful at the moment. You know, we've spoken before about how this is a season perhaps where, you know, energy levels are dropping. And so for teams like City, it's difficult for them to play. But he's basically doubling down, saying that we have to play this way. This is how Manchester City play, and this is us at our best. And the way we played 2 years ago, this was kind of the closest we've seen to it for a long, long time. And I think he's right. And I think, you know, other teams watching will treat this kind of that performance fairly ominously.
Matt, what did you make of Manchester City, the way they controlled the game? And look, it's a chance, I think, for us to wax lyrical about Kevin De Bruyne because he was sensational, the Belgian. But he played, as he described it, as a deep striker, which surprised many people, not just that he played there, but that he was so successful in the role. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he just proves that he's one of the most adaptable footballers we've ever seen in the Premier League. I think he said, you know, it took 5-10 minutes just to work out the role. It didn't sound like they'd had time to rehearse it much, but that's how good he is. And I think, like Gregor, I think just the movement was great to see, the rotation that you suddenly see Bernardo Silva, you know, in about 5 different positions. You see Cancelo in about, you know, 6 different positions, that there seemed to be this constant flux. But the speed with which it's done and the interactions it had done seemed to overwhelm Chelsea. I mean, I've seen Chelsea a couple of times over the holiday period, saw them against Villa where they were sort of doing the ganging up down that left side. There was Mount and Pulisic and Chilwell. And it was almost like the reverse was happening. They were being overwhelmed at times by the movement and the speed and the precision of it. And yeah, I mean, as someone who was sort of, yeah, you'd never cross City off the title list, but suddenly you were thinking, hang on a minute, why, you know, when we were making predictions only a week ago, yeah, why were City not more prominent? Well, because we didn't see this coming. You know, this is what they're capable of, but it's felt like quite a while since we've seen it.
Pep even said that again. You know, usually, as I say, he doesn't say much in these interviews, but he said, you know, no one's asked me this question for quite a while. You know, are you back in the title race kind of thing? You know, no one's asked me that for a while, but it's too soon. It's too soon. Of course they are. I mean, if they continue to play like that, then, you know, that was Manchester City of old.
I mean, they were stunning at times, but it, as I say, Tom, it was a much changed team. Gregor makes the point about City not being spoken about in the title race really prior to this. But I think they showed in many ways the depth of their squad yesterday because they were missing a number of players and it was still a very, very good side that they put out. Backup goalkeeper Zach Steffen maybe would have had a couple of things go differently if he had the chance again, including picking up a back pass, which always makes you look like a bit of an amateur if you're a Premier League goalkeeper. But how much are we reacting, Tom, to individual results at the moment? Because during this Christmas period, planning this podcast, it's sort of been, you know, very much week to week. The picture has changed massively. We were talking about Chelsea's title races. You know, before that, we were talking about Villa. Now it's Manchester United. Now it's Manchester City as well. How much can we take from this result, really, when it comes to City's chances?
It was just, it showed the strength and depth, really, that they had. And I think you said earlier, Hugh, that De Bruyne's positioning surprised many people. I think most of all, it surprised Chelsea. And it reminded me, looking back on it afterwards, it kind of in hindsight, of springing a surprise on them a little bit, because a kind of tactical tweak for a big game, playing De Bruyne at false nine. But it was forced upon them. It was that false nine and that rotation of players that really threw Chelsea. With each goal, with each opportunity they had, the lack of a focal point up front, they had no one to pick up. Every time Gundogan, his goal, he just slipped into space. Same with De Bruyne's. I mean, Foden's was just a brilliant piece of football. But it was Chelsea were just struggling to pick up those players.
I think I remember talking about City a few weeks back and we were focusing on Rodri and the failings in that position, basically, that without Fernandinho there, that seemed to be the weak spot that other teams were exploiting, passing around them. I mean, it almost seemed to be the best means of taking away from, you know, what still may be a potential weakness there, was just to be so overwhelming of the other side, to be so on the front foot, to have such rotation of positions and of the ball, that there was almost no time for Chelsea to exploit that. I mean, it's, you know, it's almost sort of throwing the accent back a different way, and rather than sort of trying to shore up that area, just to to move the ball around so superbly that it wasn't a problem. I mean, I do think that is going to be, you know, if they were playing a Liverpool or you know, a tough team in the Champions League, it would still be interesting whether Guardiola could dare to take this approach and whether that would be back talking about that sort of holding position and whether Rodri really is the long-term man for it.
I think that's right. You could talk about kind of tactical setups and systems and whatnot, but City just imposed themselves in the game far more than Chelsea did. And, you know, in that regard, it's about them taking the initiative and, as Tom was saying, finding the space and you know, making it difficult for Chelsea. Centre halves were like anonymous. They didn't have anyone really to mark. So you're kind of, that means that there's dominance in other areas of the pitch. And they didn't, again, we already talked about this last week, Chelsea didn't really do anything in the game to counter that. And Frank Lampard kind of admitted as much, which I found quite strange. And he's talking a lot about on-pitch decisions, as if that was something that was completely removed from him. Chelsea were just overwhelmed, I thought. And a lot of that is just the fact that City were completely at it and they moved the ball with such pace and purpose and they took the initiative.
I was disappointed with Frank Lampard, though, on the day and the way that he ran Chelsea's team because, as you say, and I was about to make this point, the two centre-halves of Chelsea had nobody to mark and they were being overwhelmed in other areas of the pitch because of it. And I was looking at him saying, look, you need to change formation. When are you going to do it? You know, not necessarily even personnel, just look at your two centre-backs. They've got absolutely nothing to do. And there was periods where Chelsea couldn't touch the ball. I mean, Manchester City just monopolised possession. And it was like, Frank, you need to change it now. This is where you earn your money. This is football management. Do something. And he did nothing until the game was completely gone. And I was disappointed in that regard. And look, there were reports straight after the game that Chelsea are planning for life without him. How true those are, we don't know, Tom. But we know how fragile the position of Chelsea manager is. Should Frank Lampard be worried?
Yeah, I think he should. I think four defeats in six games, you're bound to a club like that. I mean, he was there for long enough. He saw the amount of managers come and go there to know that this isn't the kind of form that's acceptable at a club like that. And I think the amount they spent last summer as well, and the fact it isn't really working out for Werner so far, it's certainly not working out for Havertz, despite, you know, the contracting COVID really did impact him by the sounds of things. But I think February, as long as they sort of arrest this form, getting to February will be a key month for them, because that's when you really sort of work out where your season's going, what's possible. And with Atletico Madrid in the round of 16 in the Champions League, if they're out of the Champions League at that first knockout point and it's not looking likely that they're going to be in the title race, then that's when I think you start to look at making a decision.
He did in many ways, Matt, Frank Lampard, after the game, map out what's happening at Chelsea in a, for me, surprising way. Firstly, he called it a rebuild. And he said there's going to be pain behind the scenes and on the pitch in any rebuild. Chelsea were third last season. So unless the rebuild is all about winning the title, he's currently eighth. I mean, it's a big drop off from last year, and that's not really how a rebuild's meant to work. You're meant to sort of build something.
Well, not after spending all that money, as Tom says. Equally, I take his point in the sense of you're building, and you know, you bring in Werner, Havertz, Ziyech, you know, Thiago Silva. I mean, effectively, you're bringing in half a dozen guys who are sort of first 11 players. So that is quite a lot to assimilate. And certainly in a few of those cases, Werner in particular, you've got someone who's, you know, all at sea at the moment, confidence gone, trying to play a new position, being shunted between a couple of positions. And yeah, just it's been quite painful to watch at times. I think, you know, I always just come at this point of it's a guy who is, he's learning on the job. He is, you know, and you could say, well, that's, you know, should you be getting the Chelsea job to be doing that? And that, you know, it's a fair question in itself. But I just don't think there's any doubts about it. He is, you know, experiencing things like yesterday that he, you know, might have experienced a bit at Derby County, but suddenly he's being faced with a, you know, one of the top teams in Europe overwhelming his. And you're right, he didn't respond fast. He didn't probably know what to do at that time. And you're thinking, again, should that guy be manager of Chelsea? But that's where he's at, and he's going to have to learn some of these lessons pretty fast, because Chelsea, as we know, is not a place known for its patience.
Do you think he'll be worried about any of the reports over his future, or having spent so much time with Chelsea, he knows the game now enough?
I'd be surprised. I mean, I think, you know, this is where, you know, I did a piece on it a year or two ago about the LMA actually looked at the stats of, you know, longevity in management, which, as we know, is famously short. But the biggest sort of indicator of whether you would get longer in the job was whether you had been a player at that club previously. It sort of perhaps gives you the job in the first place. It also just gives you that little bit more time than you might otherwise get. And I think Lampard will be thinking that, you know, he's got this season to prove that he is learning those lessons, that he can get some of these players functioning, and that he's got a chance to cling on. I don't think he'd be thinking he's going to get dumped in the next month or two. But yeah, as Tom rightly says, that's assuming that, yeah, he stops the rot pretty soon.
Alison Rudd, who's with us regularly, talking about Lampard needing to find leaders very, very quickly. And Henry Winter, too, talking about Frank Lampard being schooled, as I think all of us saw. Tony Cascarino has been talking about COVIDiots, though, and that's what we're going to talk about next. But I should say it's a 5-star review from me for Pep Guardiola and Manchester City at the weekend. So we need a 5-star review from you guys as well. Get online on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast provider you use. Make sure you're subscribed as well. You won't miss the next episode. And of course, if you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times, you won't miss any of our great journalism. As I say, Tony Cascarino saying COVIDiots should be hit with 3-match bans. And the reason I wanted to talk about this here was, of course, because one of those COVIDiots is from Manchester City. Pep Guardiola making a defense of his defender, Benjamin Mendy. He basically said people shouldn't judge Benjamin Mendy too strongly. I should bring you up to date with the story. You know, Manchester City have been hit with a number of players out due to positive COVID-19 test results. Well, Benjamin Mendy invited some people round for a New Year's Eve party. Let's call it that. There was a video that went out of him asking for certain guests to come over. But also Eric Lamella, Giovanni Lo Celso of Spurs, they tested positive after they were pictured with a Christmas get-together with their teammates Sergio Reguilón and West Ham's Manuel Lanzini. They subsequently have apologised as well. It's not just a Manchester City problem, this. But Pep Guardiola's response is what I was really interested in, because he basically said that people shouldn't overreact and they shouldn't be too judgmental of Benjamin Mendy and, I guess, other players that have done the same, because people up and down the country, in Pep's view, have also been doing it too, and we shouldn't be hypocrites. Matt, are bans appropriate? Are fines appropriate to deal with these players? Or, as Pep says, should we just sort of take a step back from this?
Well, it's a really interesting one, this. I mean, you find yourself thinking, well, on the one hand, you know, it shouldn't be happening, and even more stupid, putting it on Instagram, you know, putting anything out on social media. So there's the, you know, daft for doing it, double daft for advertising it, getting caught. I get Guardiola's point. I mean, you know, I'm certainly not about to jump on my high horse and say I've been perfect, but, you know, he's right. People are breaking rules in all sorts of ways. You know, I know in my vicinity, I probably shouldn't be naming names, otherwise I won't have any neighbours left. But, you know, I know people who have flouted it, and, you know, some in small ways, some, you know, some in sort of vaguely understandable ways, others in blatant ways. So I think his point was badly handled, because he should have also said that it's bloody stupid and irresponsible. I mean, I get his point, but it should have come with a tone of, this is not good enough, this is not acceptable. The issue of bans, I I'm a bit uncomfortable with for a couple of reasons, not because I think, you know, they don't deserve punishment, but does this really need to become the FA's problem? I almost have a little sympathy with them with the fact of, you know, they're meant to suddenly not just police the game, but police sort of players, you know, doing daft things, you know, in their own homes. If this is suddenly becoming a sort of FA sort of policing issue, I find that a bit sad. It should be down to the clubs. This is damaging their standing. It's potentially damaging their finances. If games get cancelled, it's damaging their, you know, bubbles, the way they can train, the way they can operate. So you would like to think that the clubs themselves would, you know, take such a dim view of this that they would handle it internally. Now, you know, we've seen a life that clubs are full of self-interest and sort of do what looks after them. But I would like to think that these players would be given, you know, a rocket, internal fine, or whatever it takes from their managers, rather than making it an FA issue.
Tom Ruddy, what do you think? Fines and bans, are they appropriate?
No, I don't think they are. I think partly because of what Pep said. I mean, firstly, the first thing to sort of say is before Christmas, I expected it. You were just sort of waiting for those first images of players that had come together, partly because a lot of people were doing it. For me, the issue is what Matt said, is that the bar for this was set pretty low, in that all that the FA and the Premier League were satisfied with was for the clubs to come out and condemn what had happened with the right tone. And so I was quite disappointed in the way in which Pep did go about talking about describing Mendy's personality as a sort of defence for the actions. It seemed irrelevant to me. I think it was very easy to deal with. You just say it's not acceptable, say it's not right, and the difficulty is that you've got so many people who have been so severely affected by this and couldn't see their family over Christmas and New Year's and see their friends. I think that's the real difficult part, is where people felt that they'd been so affected by it. So I think that's the problem.
Gregor, Pep sort of pointed the finger at other people and said, don't be hypocrites now. I know you've all been having parties as well. I found that very, very strange, a bit like Tom saying there. But he did say it was clearly wrong from Benjamin Mendy. But he also just said, you know, as Tom alluded to, he's a guy with a great heart. Don't judge him too much. You know, none of us are perfect, essentially, was the message from Pep Guardiola.
That's it, exactly. I was just going to say that I think, you know, it's come out of saying that he's really backing him. He could have been kind of harder and put the law down and said, look, this is a stupid thing to do. And let's be honest, it's how premeditated these things were. I mean, to arrange, like the Spurs one in particular, and to arrange that do, it's just kind of, it beggars belief, really. Because, and I was trying to think to myself, you know, these guys are from different countries, maybe they don't watch the news, maybe the club, they must know what's happening. The club, and Mourinho has doubled down and said it, they have to be making crystal clear what they can and can't do. And they just completely ignored it and made these extravagant plans. But coming back to Pep, I think exactly what you just said there. He was basically saying, look, none of us are perfect. This is a difficult time. He's a kind of larger-than-life character. Like, we all love him, but he's certainly flawed, and none of us are perfect. And I think if you look out in wider society, there's a lot of other young guys like him who are doing this kind of thing. I think that was his message, but whether that was the right message or not, I'm just not sure, because I agree with Matt, though. I think the FA, this is not something the FA need to be getting involved in. The club should be strict with them, though, and they should be fining them, I think. And they should perhaps leave them out, if they can, leave them out of the squad, or leave them, you know. I know it's difficult times at the moment with numbers, but it should be down to the clubs. It's not up to the FA, I don't think, to police this.
The whole episode reminded me of, I don't know if you've heard the recording recently of Tom Cruise going absolutely ballistic at the sort of people working on the recording of Mission Impossible, the latest Hollywood blockbuster, basically saying to them in very, very strong terms, the industry depends on this film. And I felt a little bit like that, you know, like, are you looking at the wider impact of what you're doing in that people's livelihoods depend in this and their health? You know, we're saying, oh, you know, as if it's just a turn of phrase. Eric Lamella's got coronavirus, so's Giovanni Lo Celso. How many other people that they saw at Christmas did they spread coronavirus to? Who else out of that group of people have they been seeing? How far has this transmission gone? You know, for me, it's like there's a massive responsibility for these players in terms of the industry, of course, but also the livelihoods of people that work for these clubs and the health of their teammates. Look at Alan Saint-Maximin and Jamal Lascelle, long COVID at Newcastle United, and the effect it's having on their careers. But of course, their health, you know, it's not just about being a footballer. You know, it's about being 60, 70 years old and still being healthy at that point in time. And I just, you know, I can't get my head around what these footballers have missed from everything that's going on. And for me, if it's my club, and it's not my club in this instance, but still, I'm a Premier League fan, I'm a football fan, you know, clubs never want to ban their own players from matches or leave them out or treat them like school kids. But does a 2-week fine really do enough? You know, these players are regularly getting fined a week's wages or 2 weeks' wages for this, that, or the other, particularly if you're Benjamin Mendy. So how much will that really have an effect on your actions?
So and, what's the alternative?
No. Well, for me, you know, you could leave them out for a game or two and you could fine them a couple of weeks' wages. There is no, you can't sack them fair enough. And it's interesting. Look, you couldn't sack people in a regular line of work. We wouldn't get sacked for it, although we'd be disciplined. I'm sure if we'd have had a New Year's Eve party for the game podcast and put pictures on Instagram, you know, the fact that it's incredibly stupid, it's almost irrelevant in this case. You know, they're not seeing the wider implications of their actions.
Would you be banned for 3 podcasts for, as you say, if you'd have been up for that, the world breathes a sigh of relief. I'm off the air. But no, I mean, yeah, in other working places, you know, football does come with this profile. You know, we talk about the responsibility of I hate the phrase role models, but yeah, they do have a potentially bigger impact, especially when they're stuck all over the front pages with pictures of Instagram. But I just do think the FA involvement definitely doesn't square with me, just because I think it's sort of, you know, is this really becoming their problem as well? I thought, you know, Roy Hodgson struck a better tone, I thought, of just being thoroughly naffed off, grumpy to say the least, about a breach from his squad. And I think, yeah, it should be reinforcing to managers that they cannot lecture their players too many times about this. They cannot lecture them too much about, as you say, just about basic health and safety, but about responsibility, first of all, to their teammates and families, about being sensible, but as you say, to the wider world. I mean, that these managers need to be sitting down with their players almost every day and reminding them. You know, some of them will still be idiots because people are idiots every now and then. But I just think, yeah, it should just, I would like to think every club, every manager has sort of seen what's happened over the weekend and just thought, right, I need to scream and shout at these guys till they're sick of hearing it from me.
Tom, would you agree with the proposition that the Premier League brings in some sort of new rule that says players who breach the coronavirus guidelines in a premeditated way, we're not talking about, you know, the things you're allowed to do in terms of support bubbles, etc. You know, if you have a party, let's call it that, 5-game ban or 3-game ban. If the Premier League brought in a new rule like that, do you think that that would be appropriate?
I don't think they could really, and I don't think they would. I think, if you know, it could be seen as bringing the game into disrepute, but I don't think they'd want to go that far, and I think they would want to let the clubs deal with it. I think for me, it kind of reminded me of going back to that, the issue of seeing players on the front pages and missing out on things that they would regularly do, or regular teenagers or young adults could do. And I think with this generation, they've grown up knowing the indiscretions that they do have that kind of responsibility and that focus on them. And you can't, you have to make those sacrifices.
You know, on the issue of it becoming an FA problem, I mean, you can already, you know, imagine it that, you know, you have a case like this, and then you have, you know, you can't just, you'd have to ask for explanations. So then you're going to have Pep Guardiola doing character references left, right and centre, or you're going to have a player saying, oh, well, I only did it because, you know, I was visiting my sickly mother, or, you know, or whatever. And is the FA going to get bogged down in case after case of that, dealing with that? That really shouldn't be, I get Tony's point. I get in the paper, I get his frustration. I get the sense of, you know, Christ, you know, these guys need to, you know, wake up and have a good look at themselves. But the idea that we sort of give the FA another kicking and say, come on, pull your finger out, I just can't see that that's realistic.
There's enough to be dealing with, isn't there, for all of them? I think the thing that, I'd be wrong to say it made me laugh, but it made me, every time there's a game cancelled in the EFL just now, there's a statement released by the EFL that says this game will be, this cancellation will be subject to an EFL investigation. And you're thinking, how many investigations have they got on the go right now? Because the games are falling left, right and centre. I think, you know, there's a lot of protocols to follow. There could be more cancellations in the Premier League. The FA have got enough on their plate. I think the players and the clubs need to take some responsibility. And hopefully after these indiscretions, maybe they'll learn that, you know, you need to toe the line there.
Big if, but imagine there's an outbreak at a club, a Premier League club, and the pictures emerge that they all had a New Year's Eve party, or someone has a birthday party in the next month, and they've all been together, you know, 30, 40 people, you know, players and non-players, let's call it that. And then there's an outbreak at the club, and it goes to the Premier League to see whether the game or not should be called off. What do you say then? Postponement or forfeit?
Poof. I don't know. It would certainly be a good argument for a postponement there. For a forfeit. I think it'd certainly be one occasion where you'd say, if you've got 14 fit players, even if they're in the youth team or whatever, get them on the pitch, because the rest of them don't deserve to be on the pitch, really, that kind of thing. So, look, that's a difficult one to answer, and hopefully we don't have to. Nobody has to.
It's going to happen. Mark my words, it is going to happen, and I will come back to you on that date because I don't think they're going to stop having parties. Let's put it that way. You're listening to The Game Podcast. Hugh Wisencroft, Gregor Robertson, Matt Dickinson and Tom Roddy with you today. Back in a moment. But a reminder, for more award-winning journalism, get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. You can enjoy it across all of your devices. Sign up today. You'll get yourself 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
so
how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Up next on The Game Podcast, it's Sheffield United. All you've got to do at this moment in time is say those two words, and any football fan, I mean, it's just like code word for the most negative thing possible, because in a sad way, it's not going the way that football fans would want things to go for Chris Wilder and Sheffield United. They were beaten once again at the weekend, 2-0 by Crystal Palace. And once again, they weren't out of the game, but they weren't really up to it as much as they've been in the past. Let's call it that. They are bottom of the table at the moment, just 2 points after 17 games. And yet, Chris Wilder doesn't really seem like his job is at massive risk. So are they, Matt Dickinson, one of, if not the most unique cases in Premier League history?
Well, unique in the sense that they're going to break records on the current trajectory, aren't they? you know, it's 2 points, is it now, from 17? Yeah, on that. I mean, it's that they are... they're going to go down as the least successful, and I'm putting that as the nicest way I can, least successful Premier League side ever. I think it's taken all of us by surprise, isn't it, that they're suffering quite so badly. I mean, there's some, a couple of sort of obvious things to point to, aren't there? And you know, Dean Henderson, you know, you lose a top class goalkeeper. Jack O'Connell getting injured, but it's both ends as well, isn't it? I mean, Brewster, am I right in thinking, hasn't scored yet this season, when you've, you know, put a record outlay there. So it's all ends of the pitch.
Chris Wilder called his side naive at times, Gregor. Strangely, and this is the thing that I thought was weird, Eberechi Eze, who I think is a fantastic player and who I watched at QPR, he's taken very well to the Premier League. He walked the ball from inside his own half into the Palace box, into the back of the net. No real challenge. And afterwards, I think Ollie Norwood was saying, oh, we should have just hacked him down. And it was like, well, you didn't need to do that. I mean, you could have just defended the situation better and he probably wouldn't have scored. I mean, the idea that you need to be kicking through players left, right and centre to stop them from scoring from 15 yards inside their own half... you know, it wasn't an unstoppable George Weah run. Let's put it that way. What on earth is going on with Chris Wilder's Sheffield United that pretty much every goal they score, they could really avoid? And I know you could say that about any goal, but I don't think it's a world beater, is it?
I don't know if that's entirely fair. I mean, because the first goal was kind of, there was a tackle and a deflection, and it felt kindly for...
It was extremely unfortunate. I'll give him that. Okay, I saw that goal and thought, when it's not going your way, it's not going your way, because they were 2 inches from making a tackle about four times in the build-up to that goal. Yeah.
And so undoubtedly, the Eze goal, as you know, as much as it was beautiful to watch and he glides across the pitch, you're right, Norwood, he skipped away from Norwood. And I think Norwood, there was one angle we saw in Norwood's kind of desperation. He was almost shouting to Ampadu to come out and sort of engage him, and that just allowed Eze the opportunity to skip past him, and then nobody closed him down. So I think you have to give Eze a lot of credit for that goal. But I think the thing with Sheffield United, you know, a lot of the things have been said, as Matt said, O'Connell, I don't think you can underestimate how important that was, because now you look at the team, and last season Sheffield United were strongest down the flanks. Enda Stevens on the left, Baldock on the right, and the way that they made combinations between, you know, Fleck on the left, and either Lundstrom or Norwood, whatever, on the right. And now, Stevens has to play left of the back three. So that means they're playing Ben Osborne on the left. Baldock wasn't playing on the right. The team just is... One injury kind of has had ripple effects through that team, and it was that finely balanced for them, because they've played the same system and the same way, and they have relationships all over the pitch, and they've had that for 3 years with the whole team. So that's the first thing. Another thing is, you know, again, it's been said, but I think nine of their defeats have been lost by one goal. Like, they have been tight, and there's been, and confidence saps, it drains. So it's been, I think, a kind of cumulative effect. They started the first game of the season against Wolves. They were two down within 6 minutes or something. And they were chasing and chasing. And after that, really, there's only a couple of teams who beat them comprehensively. And that's with the lack of confidence. That's with the lack of goal-scoring threat up front. And that's with a team that is, you know, it's much changed from last season. So, as I say, I think there's been kind of, it's a cumulative effect. And, you know, I did a piece just around Christmas where the team they just beat the record of, the worst start, was Sheffield United. 30 years ago, with a team that Chris Wilder played in, and Dave Harry Bassett was manager of. And I think they went 16 games, their 17th game, they got their first win, and they had 4 points until that point. And they stayed up. They finished 13th. And I've still refused to... I refuse to say that they are doomed. I refuse to say it. Partly because I joined a team, Northampton Town. It wasn't... And Chris Wilder just joined them as manager in January. And we were at one stage, I think we were 7 points adrift. It's not the same. And it was League Two. It's not the Premier League. And he completely... He will do a lot of business this window. I guarantee it. He will try and shake up the squad. You know, he's tried to do it kind of gradually and introduce younger players and whatnot. And it's not really worked. He will shake it up as much as he can, and he won't give up. And I refuse to say that they're down and out yet.
12 points from safety. Maybe Greg has opened the door to a reason why I was asking. It's such a unique situation because I can't imagine any other club that would have kept their manager, but they've got the history, and maybe that's a reason why they feel like it's still possible.
But the other reason, though, quickly, is that if they go down, who's better to bring them up? And who got them there?
Well, yeah, I understand that argument, but I think there are times when you watch a team get relegated and you feel the confidence going away so much that you don't believe that the next year they're going to be any good either, because
Norwich.
But Norwich still tried to play. You're right. Okay, I'll give you that, because Norwich still play now the same way they played when they were relegated from the Premier League. But I don't think I don't think they're falling out of the league in the same way that Sheffield United are at the moment.
No, and Norwich also. Norwich went up and didn't invest as heavily as other clubs did, and they have this mindset of being in the top 26 clubs in the country. I mean, Sheffield United is a different situation, because they totally overachieved last season and have completely underachieved this season. Presumably they want to be somewhere in the middle throughout those two seasons, wouldn't they?
Should he get sacked, Tom Roddy? I know Gregor won't like me asking this question.
No, at all. It's a valid point.
No, I don't think so, because of what he did last year. And I think when Bilic got sacked, it made me think immediately back to the day they got promoted, and I was at that game, and you had the fans, because of course they weren't allowed in the ground, at this window singing his name, and they weren't the most impressive side. They didn't necessarily deserve to come up to the Premier League, but we know it's a fickle business, but it's just you kind of just want them to turn it round. And I think because of what he did last year, it gives him that credit to go again next year. But I think it's just such a pity because of last year, and it's just so puzzling. I mean, I think Derby had 6 points after 17 games in the year when they ended with 11. It's absolutely catastrophic form. But what's interesting as well is looking back to last year, it was slightly fine margins then. Their top goal scorers had 6 goals. They didn't have tons of goals in the team. They just got games over the line.
I wonder if Chris Wilder will keep his job. I think he will. I think he has that goodwill. And I know we've spoken about it before in terms of where clubs want to be. If Sheffield United are happy with this, then I'm happy for them. But I'd love to see them get a few results, because I actually think the way that they stayed in games, you know, they warrant a couple of wins for their fans sometime soon as well. We'll see if Chris Wilder can turn things around at Sheffield United. Another manager who's being charged with turning things around is the new Paris Saint-Germain boss, Mauricio Pochettino, the former Spurs manager. Of course, he took them to a Champions League, but he's been out of work since November of 2019, and he is back in the game. He's replacing Thomas Tuchel, of course, who was sacked by PSG. He joins the French champions with them third in Ligue 1 and looking ahead to a last 16 clash with Barcelona in the Champions League. Now, Matt, for me, this was one of the most pointless managerial appointments from, in my opinion, the manager's side of things, because it's as, in terms of a big club, it's as lose-lose as it gets. You win the league, no one cares. Doesn't make a jot of a difference. You're meant to win the league, and obviously you're expected to. you need to win the Champions League or you'll pretty much be deemed a failure, as most of their previous managers have been for not winning it. So I don't think he's possibly got the squad to do that. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if he's even good enough to do that. You know, it remains to be seen what sort of manager he is in terms of this big level of club. But also, I just wanted to see him in a more competitive environment to help him progress. But this is just me. If I was his agent, I would have sent him to Juve or Real Madrid or maybe Man United. Who knows? Can he win in this job, Matt?
I think he can. Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, for one thing, you get to work with, you know, better players than he's ever worked with before. You know, I mean, well, I guess, don't know how many months you'll end up working with Mbappe before another bid comes in from Real Madrid or somewhere else. But yeah, you've got him and Neymar and Verratti, and you've got some of the top, you know, players around, guys who have reached a Champions League final and are capable of you know, hitting those heights. So that's, you know, you've got a extraordinary caliber of players. You're talking about, you know, a hugely ambitious club. That brings its own challenges, I think. If there was anything, if I was his agent, I'd be mindful against it. It is the politics that's done for Thomas Tuchel. I think, you know, it's not a club where the coach necessarily has the biggest say about arrivals. It's a club where, you know, someone like Neymar is a sort of, you're dealing not just with a player, but a sort of one-man corporation, and all kinds of complications that Tuchel complained about, that he was as much a sort of a diplomat as a coach at times, having to navigate it. So I don't think it's easy job. Like you say, there is another challenge that you're trying to win the Champions League while, you know, facing some non-competitive domestic matches. But that, I can see why he's taken it. Put it that way, I think it gets him back at work in a high-profile club. It's got the possibility of, you know, he wants to coach, and you want to coach top players. And I hope he does well.
I think you said Hugh's lose-lose. I actually felt the opposite. I felt like it was a win-win for Pochettino, really, because I don't think he'll particularly enjoy his time there when it does come to an end, because you can predict it would turn out the same way that it has done for Tuchel, that it did do for Emery, exactly as Matt laid out, that it's, you can win the league, but the Champions League is the holy grail, and whether they're good enough to kind of get that is questionable and unlikely at the moment. But the main question mark over Mauricio Pochettino was, he's an excellent coach, but can he win trophies? And at PSG, it's almost a given. If he doesn't win the league, then it's an absolute catastrophe. But it's likely he will. So say he comes out of this in 2 years with a league title under his belt and he hasn't won the Champions League and he gets sacked for that, I still see it as a successful period for him, because a major club in England still takes him.
Gregor, what do you think? Could he have aimed, maybe not higher, but in a different direction? Serie A, Arsenal. No, Real Madrid. Let's be realistic. There were big clubs. I know PSG is a big club, but you know what I mean. There were huge clubs that were interested in Mauricio Pochettino. Was it just getting back to work that was the main consideration?
I think probably it was, yeah. But I have to say, I kind of agree with Tom in that, you know, he's not won anything. That was all. It won't be nothing to him. Nobody will care if he wins the French League. He will. He definitely will. If he wins any silverware there, that will be a big thing for him. And, you know, yes, winning the Champions League is the Holy Grail, but if he doesn't do it, that doesn't make him a failure. It might cost him his job, but that doesn't make him a failure. And he will be working with... The thing is, it's, you know, it does seem a bit of an uncomfortable fit when you think of what we've learned about Pochettino in his time at Spurs, about it being, you know, somebody who really wants to build relationships, and it's the collective and the team, and, you know, those kind of human touch, those human instincts, that's what he thrives on. And he's going to a club where it's all about the kind of these individuals, essentially. And when PSG succeeded last year and getting to the final, they seemed to have kind of throw that off a little bit, and they looked like more of a team. So that's his challenge. It's about fitting Neymar and Mbappe, two of the kind of most individualistic talents in the world, into a team. And I wouldn't imagine he's going to be someone who's going to indulge in their kind of, if they're not willing to do that. So, you know, there could be some conflict there too. And even that is going to be something that will be a learning experience for him.
It's going to be intriguing to watch, but I think the judgment will come down. Still think the judgment of Mauricio Pochettino's time there will come down to how they perform in the Champions League. And I still think it's going to be difficult for him, but the way football's going at the moment, pretty much anything can happen. And they got to the final last year, so who knows. Pleasure to see him back in football though, because I think he is just one of those really great, nice guy managers who loves a project. And as I said before on the podcast, I love a project. So really intrigued to see what he does. But I read newspaper reports today that Moyes Keane's going there permanently. So if he's starting up front, I don't necessarily think the Champions League is going to arrive anytime soon. Just before we go, guys, we wanted to end on our funniest fails in football. I'll tell you why. I'm sure you saw it. Timo Werner of Chelsea managing to injure himself on the corner flag against Manchester City at the weekend. I don't exactly know what he was trying to do, but he hurt himself. So we thought we'd ask about funniest fails in football to end. Tom, I'm going to start with you. Funniest football fails, what do you think?
Mine sadly isn't something we actually saw, but it was a story from a few years ago. It was the start of the Champions League campaign in 2017, and Madrid were playing Apoel Nicosia, and they'd had a bit of a bad start to the season. I think they'd drawn against Valencia, and it was Marco Asensio who was sort of coming to the fore at that time, this real talent coming to the fore, and he'd scored the equalising goal in that game. But he couldn't play in the Apoel game because he decided his leg hairs were a little bit too long, had hacked at them with a razor and got his pimple infected so much that he couldn't lift his socks. And that, for me, was the first major failure that came to mind.
I mean, I have to give a personal one, I think, in that playing a game for Northampton Town against Wycombe Wanderers a few years back, and I'd been booked in the first half for a tackle, solid tackle, and we were 1-0 up, and I think there was about maybe 7 or 8 minutes to go, and we got a throw-in, and I was taking the throw-in, and we were also trying to bring on a substitute, and so the fourth official standing on the side with the board trying to put in the number and stuff, and the referee's like, take the throw-in, and I was pointing to the sub corner, and I kept toing and froing. He's like, take the throw in. I was like, look, we're bringing a sub on. He's take the throw in. Look, and he showed me a second yellow card. So I was sent off for failing to take a throw in, and we conceded in like a 94th minute equaliser. And to say Chris Wilder wasn't happy afterwards is an understatement. So yeah, that's probably my biggest fail in football.
Matt,
I'm going to struggle to beat that one, I think, but I have to go to my my pitch where I play for a super vets team over 50s, and so this is going to the right down the leagues to the very bottom. But yeah, a mate of mine hadn't played football for more than five. He was over 50. He'd given up the game after he snapped his Achilles, and after a lot of badgering, I said, "Look, you know." This is great, you know, get back into the game, feel like a kid again. So he said, all right, I'll do it. Anyway, he got the ball at one stage. He was charging into the box, and he was it sort of opened up for this glory shot at goal in his first game back in football. And he was on his wrong foot, and basically he went to shoot, got his legs in, and absolutely sliced it so that it didn't even hit the corner flag, went out for a throw-in, and he tore his hamstring in the process of this sort of giddy moment of just like, I'm back. And we had to stop the game for about 10 minutes, partly to carry him off, but mostly to stop laughing, basically. And oddly enough, he's not been back on a football pitch since. So, if ever I need a chuckle, I slightly cruelly think of that moment.
I've got a couple from very recent times. A few years ago, you might remember Sam Allardyce talking about Nigel Farage, the politician, saying what a big fan of his he was. He said he never wanted to vote again, but Nigel Farage might make him because he thought he was such a great politician. Unfortunately, Big Sam has now found out that due to Brexit, he's unable to sign a few of his major targets for West Bromwich Albion this January because they can't get work permits. So that real pleasure for Sam Allardyce there. He's going to give his mate Nigel a ring. I'm sure he'll sort you something out, Sam. And also Sergio Reguilón, who did an interview in Spain talking about Jose Mourinho buying him a glazed ham, I think it was, for Christmas because he knew he was going to be alone. Ha! Well, now we know the truth, don't we, Sergio? Because he wasn't alone. So, listen, if that's going to happen, don't go to the newspapers and have an interview about it and then get photographed on Instagram or social media or whatever. Clearly not alone on Christmas Day. What a fail from Sergio. Yeah, I won't call him a covidiot, but I'm sure Tony Cascarino would. Gentlemen, pleasure to be with you once again on the Game Podcast. Matt Dickinson, Gregor Robertson and Tom Roddy, thank you very much. And as I mentioned, you can read Tony Cascarino's views on those covidiots right now on the Times app. Remember, you can get yourself a digital subscription to the Times and the Sunday Times and enjoy more of our award-winning journalism on all of your devices. Sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/the game to get started. We'll be back on Thursday. We'll see you then.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.